This is like a low-key mega watch here.
I love it. I love it. Yeah,
you love it.
I do. Oh, look, I mean, I think
tell me
it's
why.
Complete. Well, it's absurd in many ways. Well, look, everything we talk about is absurd. This
yeah,
is
of
like
course.
Extremely absurd. It's a really cool thing. And like, if I ever come across somebody wearing this watch, I'm gonna be like, yeah, man, you're the man. You're doing it right now.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. I can honestly say I think this past week was the first really buzzing week in the watch industry in 2020. It's the first week that for me felt like kind of a quote-unquote normal week. The Watches and Wonders digital platform launched, and basically we got a virtual watch trade show. It was the first week of the year where we just had wall-to-wall new releases, and I thought it'd be fun to get Ben and Jack into a little virtual studio to chat about the highlights. So we covered some of the bigger brands like Cartier and IWC and Panerai, who released full collections. And then we also covered brands like Vacheron, Lange, Hermès, Piaget, who released a couple pieces here and there. So we look at what's coming, what's here, who's making big statements, and who's kind of riffing on their classics to create something new, just as watch fans, not even as watch journalists and reporters. This is exciting stuff. We've got new watches to talk about. So without further ado, let's get into it. We are rolling on my end so that we don't have a situation like last week. We, by the way, this past weekend found out on Sunday that I had not recorded the intro when we did it. So
you forgot to press record?
Yeah, exactly. I forgot to hit the button, so we got to re-record that on Sunday.
That's like that time Jack shot that watch without a memory card in the camera.
Actually, yep. I think my most distinguished moment was publishing that. What the hell was the brand?
It was an Armin Strom.
Armin Strom.
Upside down.
Yeah, all the photos were upside down.
Yeah, we're all really good at our jobs.
Yeah, we're all total pros. Hey guys, how's it going?
Going great.
Yeah, still here.
Little Friday afternoon Zoom call.
Nothing better.
So it's been a big Friday. It's been a big week. This week feels like it's gone on, I don't know, probably like a month and a half, maybe.
Yeah,
we finally got some new watches this week.
Sure did. It's exciting.
Yeah, it's like the first week that's felt, I guess, like kind of normal in the watch industry. I mean, we're not in Switzerland, so it's a little not normal, but it's close to normal.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have new watches to talk about, which feels good. You know, we've had some kind of a trickle out. We had some Grand Seikos. We saw some other new things that kind of dropped here and there. So far this year, but I mean, this is April 24th. And, this is the first big, like, you know, onslaught of new product from major brands, and it feels good. Feels good to be back in the saddle for sure.
Yeah. It feels like a normal trade show week.
Except, of course, you're in the house from Ex Machina, right? And I'm
yes.
in my parents' basement, and Steven is in his bedroom.
Yes, exactly. We're all
so, like a trade
belong.
Show, but that. Yeah,
exactly. We're all where we belong, really, if we're being honest.
I know I've said this before, but the longer I use this as a background, the more I wish it were actually my house.
It does look really nice, I have to say.
Yeah, it does look nice.
I could see you in that house, Jack.
Oh, man, so could I.
the big news is obviously this virtual Watches and Wonders thing that's happening this weekend. We're recording this Friday afternoon, so the watches that most people will see tomorrow on Saturday were released earlier today to the press, and we were able to write about them. So by extension to our audience, we're like, what, 3 hours out from most of these things dropping. So we'll talk about those in a minute. There's a, you know, over a dozen brands to talk about, but we unexpectedly got some things earlier this week. And Jack, I wanted you to maybe talk to us a little bit about the first one, which is that Seiko called a sort of impromptu press conference on Wednesday and released a ton of new watches.
Yeah, I haven't counted, but it's literally dozens. So we're going to be rolling out coverage on those probably over the next several months, I would think, because availability for some of them is later this year. But there was, you know, kind of a Top of the Pops were, I think for our readers, were a couple of new dive watches and a new Seiko Presage. So we got the S23631 and S23629 tunas, which you know, are certainly fan favorites going way back. And these particular versions actually had the quartz movements in them, which is not a new thing for the for the tuna watches at all. It's basically just a super super technical dive watch. It's really a purpose built saturation diver's timepiece, and with all the sort of technical bells and whistles you would expect. And one of the great things about, or one of the interesting things about Seiko saturation diver watches is they don't actually have helium release valves. The idea was, basically don't let the helium in the first place, and then you won't have to worry about it getting out. So, pretty much from the beginning, their gasketing systems have sort of emphasized, just preventing the helium, when you're in a saturated a decompression chamber from, getting into the watch in the first place.
That feels like a very Seiko approach to the problem, right? Like, it's the exact opposite tack that the Swiss took, right? Like, they're like, oh, the gas is going to get in, let's let it out. And Seiko's like, why would we even allow this to be a problem in the first place?
Yeah, it's funny. Kind of, it reminds me for some reason of that Lamborghini Miura that we had at H10, and I'd never actually seen one, in the metal before. And you look in, and the first thing I noticed in the driver's compartment was a fire extinguisher. And I was like, yeah, that's like such a characteristically Italian solution, Engine catches fire, put in a fire extinguisher. I mean, the Germans would have just made sure it didn't catch fire in the first place.
Very true. We got some other Seiko divers too. And I got to say, my favorites, I think, of the bunch are, there's four references. It's the SPB 143, 145, 147, and 149. And they're reinterpretations of Seiko's first diver, which we got as an anniversary piece a couple years ago. But these are awesome. And like, most of them are under or right around $1,000. They're 40.5 millimeters. They're just like a no BS mid-century style dive watch. And if they're anything like most Seiko divers, they're probably built tough as nails. They're pretty affordable. The colorways are nice. Like, I think these are going to be extremely successful watches.
Yeah, James's deck for that story was Shut Up and Take My Money.
Yeah, which I think is pretty apt. And I have a funny feeling James will end up like living by that and actually buying one. But
yeah, I think so.
I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on the idea of these being, non-limited reissues? They did a limited edition a couple years ago. Do you think that kind of like cheapens it in any way, or do you think it's kind of a nice thing? I don't know. I feel like people have pretty strong opinions about that.
Yeah, I don't think so. There's a little bit of a tendency among brands who have a strong vintage hand to play to double or triple or quadruple dip on classic designs, but this is a very different watch at a very different price point. Well, not very very different from a design perspective, but it sits at a very different price point. And I don't know. I think they're darn good looking watches, and why not?
Cool. Yeah. Last one I want to talk about in terms of Seiko divers, and then we'll move on a little bit, is the new Willard models, which actually came out. We wrote about them before this press conference on Wednesday, but I think they're worth mentioning, right?
Yeah, and again, these are not a copy paste of the original, so-called Captain Willard. The new models are the SPB 151 and SPB 153. And full disclosure, we are reading those reference numbers off of our computers. We have not committed them to memory.
Correct.
What? Well, I have.
Ben has memorized the entire Seiko catalog for the year, and there will be a test later.
All the Panerai reference numbers also. Shake my head. Right. We're fired.
Yeah, that's it, Jack. We're done.
Yeah. It's pretty much the same reaction as to the divers we were just talking about. I think it's a really, really great-looking watch. A little bit more wearable than the original Willard. I'd certainly love to have one.
It's smaller and thinner than the original Willard,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I believe so.
I think I've always liked that watch in terms of its design, but it's always been way too big. I'm curious to get one of these on my wrist and see if maybe this can be my like chunky Seiko diver.
Yeah, you don't actually own a Seiko diver yet, do you?
SKX 013. I own the little one, but yeah. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
Like you said, tons more Seiko releases. We'll talk more about those in the future as we kind of get the full collection up on the site. But the other sort of pre-Watches and Wonders thing this week actually came. Ben is the one who flagged this for me earlier this week. AP has kind of gotten in this habit of quietly dropping things onto their website and just not telling anybody, which I think is funny for a brand that's like kind of known for making a splash. And it's sort of like not aggressive, but kind of like, a little bit aggressive designs. And they've started doing this thing where they just like put watches on their website and put a little thing that says new next to them and wait for people to find them. And you found something earlier this week.
Yeah, I mean, so lucky for you, Stephen, I wake up every morning and check the AP website for new watches. That's what I do every day. Before I shower or brush my teeth, I go into armandpiguet.com. I don't know. Somebody sent it to me. I forget exactly how we found it. But yeah, AP has been slowly getting away from the launch and in fact, getting away from Watches and Wonder or the SIHH in general, right? Even if SIHH or Watches and Wonders were to happen as planned, they were not going to be there. You know, they wanted to go off and kind of do their own thing. Francois had told me in the past that the goal was to do kind of an unveiling, not unlike what you might see from like an Apple, where they get, you know, a bunch of journalists and retailers and press and whoever into a room together and go deep on the AP lineup. They haven't done that yet, as far as I know, but I think they were planning to do it with the remaster, that kind of vintage style chronograph that they remade this year. But obviously, you know, the coronavirus had something else to say about that. So, you know, AP is taking, you know, dramatically opposing tacks to how they present new product. There is, A, we're going to make like a BFD about it and say like, hey, we're going crazy like they did with 1159, like they plan to do with remaster, and they probably will do again with other products down the road. And then on this launch, which is basically another Royal Oak, I mean, not basically, it is another Royal Oak, just in a different size. So this is 34 millimeter self-winding as opposed to, you know, 32 millimeter quartz or 33 millimeter quartz, which is currently in the catalog as well. This, you know, regardless of how they communicate about it, I think it's a great product. I think this is something that a lot of people, man and woman, would find interesting. You know, it's still a very, very high-end movement. It is not the 3120. You know, it's not the same movement that's in the larger movement. I'm sorry, the larger watch. It is the same case and dial and everything that goes into it. And as you guys surely know by now, or hopefully know by now, that means you've been reading Hodinkee, like this watch is just as much about the quality of the dial, how the dial is made, as well as the dial or the quality of the case and the bracelet, as it is about the movement. That's not to, you know, kind of poo-poo the movement in any way. Their movements are wonderful. This is just a sweet spot of a watch. You know, the movement maybe is not as high end as you would find in the 15500 or the 37 millimeter Royal Oak, but it's still a great high quality Swiss movement. And again, you know, the goal here is not so much to appeal to you know, kind of movement files, but rather like just appeal to people that want a slightly smaller self-winding Royal Oak. And I think they're, you know, based on the comments alone, people are going crazy for this watch already. So I think it's a smart move. You know, I mean, in many ways, I was thinking about this the other day when I saw it, like, I think there's some ambition from AP to be a little bit more like Rolex. And I think there's some ambition from Rolex to be a little bit more like AP. You know, I think Rolex wants to go high end and hard to get. And I think AP wants to be like as ubiquitous as Rolex and be like, hey, we've got a Royal Oak for every size that you could ask for. And I think they're really seeing that here. And, you know, as we've said many times, like, you know, the most popular watch Rolex has ever made is a very small two-tone ladies' Datejust. And I think, you know, basically what we're seeing here, and of course, that's a self-winding watch. What we're seeing here is basically that from AP. You know, we're seeing a watch that like is slightly less expensive, and it is. I mean, it's still a lot of money, but it's slightly less. And, you know, this would be a perfect watch for a woman or a man to just wear every day and not give too many considerations to.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think the kind of filling out the portfolio aspect of this caught my eye pretty quickly, which is that, I mean, now we have self-winding Royal Oaks in 34, 37, 39, and 41 millimeters in steel, gold, two-tone, you know, platinum in some sizes. Like, you can kind of get
and frosted.
Whatever.
Don't forget about frosted.
And frosted. Oh, frosted's so good. So you can kind of get whatever you want, which is cool. At the same time, I wonder how, you know, as they do things like remaster and code, you know, it's interesting to see AP always balancing the Royal Oak with its other things. You know, I think, you know, Royal Oak's got to be what 90%+ of people know AP for. So, kind of balancing that success while also trying to make sure they have other horses in the race, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the remaster is a great first step. You know, you and I obviously saw it together a few months ago. Yeah. The watch is wonderful. You know, it's there are certainly things that I think you and I would change.
Sure.
You know, first of all, like why make it automatic? You know, it could be so much thinner and so much more true to form if it were manually wound. But, you know, speaking with Michael Friedman, who's, you know, is a historian and also head of complications there, like the goal was not to do a recreation. Mm. It was to interpret the original watch. And I think, you know, that as far as I know, has been received very well. You know, it was kind of introduced kind of in the early days of the pandemic. So I'm not really sure how many were kind of put to market, being that, you know, basically the global watch retail chain is closed. But I think that's a really nice first step. I think, you know, Code, for all of its faults, is also it's the right decision. You know, like you can debate, you know, the execution of it, but it's the right decision to start doing, you know, time onlys, chronographs, you know, mid-level comps, as well as the high comps in other cases. And, you know, giving new life to other lines. You know, AP is doing exceptionally well. I mean, it remains so strong. You can't get, I mean, it's funny, you know, you were saying, Stephen, like now you can kind of get any Royal Oak you want, but of course you actually can't get any Royal Oak you want,
right,
because
right.
You can't get them, you know, like in
That's
steel,
true,
you
yeah.
cannot get these watches.
Yeah.
And I would imagine there'll be a run on these smaller watches for a little bit too. So I think they need to come up with product that is sellable. And I think, you know, the one funny thing that our readers tend to forget is like, these brands don't like it when they can't sell a watch. You know what I mean? I think like the average consumer is like, oh, of course, like Rolex is minimizing supply and AP is doing the same. It's like, that's not how businesses work. You know, like to pay salaries, to make money, you need to sell things. So I think, you know, AP is currently looking for products that they can sell, always under the idea that like the 15202 and the 15500 and all the steel stuff is going to be difficult to get.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting that, you know, they released four references of this 34 millimeter Royal Oak. And the steel one they did with the silver dial, not with the blue dial. I think like
yeah.
they're still trying to keep that steel blue dial Royal Oak hard to get. And like, I don't think they're going to make a ton of these 34 millimeters. I don't think they're going to flood the market or anything, but you know,
yeah.
not kind of juicing that supply, I think is an interesting choice.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the other thing to mention here is like AP, they're not only are their global boutiques closed, but their actual manufacturers closed, you know, so
right.
I don't know when we'll see any of these, you know, unless
sure.
they made them well in advance, which they probably did make
sure.
some. But, you know, speaking to another CEO of another high-end, very high-end watch company recently, like, you know, at a certain point, they're going to run out of stock, you know, they're you know, casemaker, basically all of Switzerland, the manufacturing side is still shut down. So unless things open back up, which I know that, you know, things are about to, you know, the whole industry could run out of stock. And that could be much more of a problem for the industry than, you know, kind of waning demand. I think the demand is there. I think the supply is going to be even more difficult than before.
Mm, interesting. Well, you know, kind of the opposite of that, right, is all these new watches, right? Like we got, you know, we ran, I think we're recording this, like I said, on Friday. I think in the last 24 hours, we've run 40 something new watch introductions and we have more coming over the next.
Might be
too
many new introductions.
It might be. And so, yeah, so as potential supply wanes, we're still seeing brands ramp up for this upcoming year. So, you know, yeah. to set this up just a little bit, you know, right now in a normal year, the three of us would be in Switzerland. I think right now we'd be in Geneva getting ready for tomorrow morning for the opening of Watches and Wonders, used to be SIHH. Instead, we're here reporting on a virtual show from our laptops at all of our respective kitchen tables and our parents' offices and parents' basements. So, you know, it's a different way to do a trade show, but it's still happening.
Still, look, we're still getting it done. I mean, you know, the fact
yeah.
that we put up 40 stories already, I mean, that's not so bad. Not so bad at all. And I think, you know, the interest, you know, I've said this, I think, on the last podcast, but, the, you know, the interest in watches is stronger than ever. I mean, our you guys obviously know well, like our editorial traffic is up considerably, shop traffic's up considerably. I mean, people are pretty psyched to get into watches right now. So I expect great results of the 40 stories we've already published, and I expect stronger results of the stories that are still to come over the weekend.
Yeah, same. You know, so I thought it'd be nice to go through the releases kind of brand by brand and give people a little bit of an overview. You know, there's a lot to dig through. I really do encourage people to dig into these posts. You know, you get a real sense of the details of the watch, but you also get our editor's kind of first thoughts and really We encourage people to editorialize here. We encourage people to inject their personalities. So, you know, if you read one of Jack's stories, you're going to get Jack's thoughts on the watch, not just kind of an objective rundown of specs. Same thing if you read one of mine or James's or John's or anybody else's. So I kind of split these brands up into some categories. And the first category I want to talk about are the brands that went big. There's three brands that, to me, this felt like a normal year's collection, and in some cases bigger than a normal year's collection. And then later we'll talk about some other brands. So these brands, first up is Cartier, who, you know, I think is having an extremely strong year. Jack, do you maybe want to give us a little bit of an overview? I know both of you got a chance to see some of these watches in the metal a couple weeks ago. So can you maybe give us a little rundown of this year's Cartier collection?
Yeah, there was basically we had new Santos Dumont models. We had the reintroduction of the Pasha, which is a watch that was first launched in 1985 and has existed in a number of different incarnations over the course of its lifetime. Fairly divisive, you know, sort of niche design. And I found it very, very appealing. And then there's the my personal favorite for the year, the Tank Asymmetrique. Is out in the Privé collection. So this is, I think, the fourth basic model to be reintroduced to the Cartier Privé collection. And I have to say, when I saw it in Paris, it was love at first sight.
Yeah, Ben, what were your thoughts having seen the watches?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Pasha is divisive, as Jack mentioned. You know, it is about as Cartier as Cartier gets. You know, I mean, there's just nobody else that makes anything like it. I mean, in my mind, and I think I probably got this from some experience in my you know, earlier years, like, that watch belongs with a Countach. Like, you buy that watch, you drive a Countach. Like, that's just what you do. Like, there's no other way to wear that watch, you know?
That is not what I would have expected at all, but it makes sense, actually.
Yeah, the other thing I really appreciate about the Pasha watch is that they actually made a golf version of it, where there's, like, four little apertures at, like, 2, 4, 6, and 8, or something like that. And you can actually count how many strokes you and your co-golfers are racking up. It's like one of those super inside baseball weird things that, like, why was that ever made, you know? I've thought about it. they're probably gonna, like, skyrocket right now. But it's just, like, such a goofy thing. But the Pasha is, like, it is a straight fashion watch. You know, it's a watch for people that are aesthetically inclined, that are, you know, tend to be more kind of higher fashion focused than, I would say, current company here, I would say. But, you know, it's peak Cartier. You know, there's like, this is a real design object from Cartier. Not at all my thing. You know, I love Cartier so much, as you guys do too, I know. But that one is just not my thing, and that's okay. I think the other watches this year are exactly my thing. And, like, you know, I kind of want all of them. You know, the new Santos Dumont stuff, having a hand-wound watch now, as opposed to quartz in the basic steel watch is, you know, it's perfect. You know, the platinum pieces with the special dials and special accessories boxes are really wonderful. And the asymmetric, I mean, the asymmetric is something I've long lusted over, you know, whether vintage, new, you know, the watch they did in the early 2000s or late 90s, just amazing. You know, the last re-edition they did in platinum, which has kind of become a cult object now, had two lugs. This one has three lugs. For me, I prefer the two lugs. It was made historically with both two and three lugs, so I understand why they chose to do three this time. The execution of it is just dynamite. Like, it's just a killer on the wrist. Just for whatever reason, I prefer the two lug version. But yeah, I think, you know, the Santos stuff and the asymmetric, I mean, again, that is like the it's just as much Cartier as the Pasha is, just in a very different way. And, you know, again, I really love two out of the three. The third I respect, but it's just not for me. That's okay. But yeah, the asymmetric is a killer. Platinum one, I really love the platinum Santos Dumont as well this year.
Yeah, I feel like the Pasha has this really interesting vibe. It's one of the, it's a watch that sort of feels like it's, you know, to me, saying, I'm a Pasha, take it or leave it.
Like, yeah, that's it.
Yeah, totally.
And you got to respect that, you know?
Yeah. I hear what you're saying about the Lamborghini, though. I mean, you know, coming out in 85, I was, you know, starting to go out in New York City after college for the first time. And I remember, you know, seeing those watches on people's wrists. And I remember seeing them in the, you know, the fashion pages and the newspapers. And, you know, it was definitely, you know, one of the hip watches to have, you know, back then.
Yeah, I mean, the Pasha is, you know, believe it or not, like, it's an icon, you know, in terms of watches that were designed, you know, past the 1970s, like in the 1980s or more recent. I couldn't think of something that's probably, you know, as iconic. I mean, maybe Lange 1, but in a totally different way.
Yeah.
I mean, what's come out, Jack, since the Pasha that's kind of bigger than that? I mean, all the Panerai stuff, even though it became popular in the 90s, like, that's obviously 1930s and 40s design stuff. What's bigger than that? I don't really know.
Yeah, I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I mean, I'm sure that if I thought long and hard enough, I'd come up with something. But it's, you know, instantly recognizable design, very characteristically Cartier. Is Cartier showing their, you know, sort of whimsical, fun side, which they don't, you know, you look at Cartier, you think about Cartier, and you think about its history. I mean, this is like, you know, a white glove jeweler, the king of jewelers, the jeweler of kings, you know, the company that put platinum and diamonds on the map. And, you know, usually, you know, you get this sense of sort of regal, not disdain necessarily, but, you know, regal hauteur from Cartier. And when they kind of like bust out and make something that's, you know, fun and playful, it's always really interesting.
Yeah. That's actually why I love the skeletonized Tank asymmetrics. So there's the standard models that look very classic, very traditional. And then there's these skeletonized versions. And to me, there's something just so like fun and over the top about it. Like, they took this icon of this like super classic, refined, geometric, like very precise watch, and it just looks like it's gone absolutely insane, right? And like you said, Jack, it's when you can see Cartier having fun and like riffing on its own thing and doing it in a way that's like obviously self-conscious and like self-aware. There's just something so charming and nice about it, and it feels real. It doesn't feel like a put on at all.
Yeah. One of my favorite writers once said that the difference between luxury and chic is that luxury is generally completely humorless, and chic is intelligent and has a sense of humor. And I think that's a really chic watch.
Thank you for remembering that quote, Jack.
Perfect. Yeah, do you guys have any other Cartier thoughts?
I mean, I think, as you said, Stephen, like, you know, it's Cartier is the biggest brand at the SIG or at the Watches and Wonders Geneva. So it's nice to see them go hard. You know, I think it sends, frankly, a very important signal to the world that, like, hey, like, we're not taking this year off. And I think that, you know, if you speak to the average kind of knucklehead watch enthusiast, like, because Rolex and Patek aren't doing anything, they think that the whole world is shutting down. And like, that's not true at all. I mean, Cartier is right up there with those guys in many ways. You know, on par, if not above, in terms of influence. You know, so it's nice to see, you know, the flagship Richemont brand kind of really going for it and doing commercial stuff, which is what Pasha is. I mean, this is like, you know, kind of bread and butter stuff, as well as having some really high design, you know, wonderful pieces. And also on the women's side, the new women's product is wonderful.
Mayon.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm really appreciative of Cartier, you know, kind of going hard in the middle of all this, just from a signal perspective, you know?
Yeah, I agree. You know, if we want to move on to another brand that's going hard and another like big Richemont brand that I think is doing some signal sending here is IWC. So, you know, IWC typically picks a collection every year, and that collection gets an overhaul. You know, last year we saw Spitfire, which was kind of a sub-collection, I guess, of the Pilots. And we saw a few other things, but this year we're getting another complete overhaul, and this time it's the Portugieser. So it's, I think, a toss-up maybe between Pilot and Portugieser as to which is more quintessentially IWC, but whichever side you come down on, I think it's two sides of the same coin, right? Like, I can't imagine IWC without either of those product ranges kind of at its heart. And there's some damn good-looking new Portugiesers here.
Agreed. I mean, you nailed it again. Like, you know, this is as much part of IWC's history as the Pilot watch. You know, to be honest with you, in my life and in my experience before Hodinkee, like, the Portuguese was probably more a part of IWC than Pilot's watch. You know, as I've said many times, like, when I was working in consulting and kind of, you know, briefly in finance, like, when you got, you know, your first $5,000 or whatever it was, like, you either bought a Submariner or you bought a Portuguese. And that's it. Like, those are the two watches that, like, a young guy were really, you know, considering and, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago. And I think the Portuguese is still such a, you know, it really is a cult classic. It's an icon I can't tell you how many people I've met over the years that said my first great watch was a, you know, was an either an 8-day or hand wound or, you know, some version of the Portuguese. I love the new product. I think that, you know, this potentially could be, you know, a game changing line for them if they could deliver it, you know. Yeah. I just think it's core. Like it goes in the opposite direction of what everything else is doing right now, which is like everything is on bracelets. Everything is steel and sportsy and, you know, Roy Loki. And, you know, they've done that with their Ingenieur and things like that. This is kind of flouting that and saying, hey, we're going to go like dress watch, round case, you know, very classical. Their perpetual is very kind of, you know, three register, 3940-ish. You know, it's very traditional Swiss watchmaking. And I'm appreciative of it for sure.
What did you guys think about the move of actually creating two yacht club models within the Portugieser line?
Yeah, I think it's smart. Like, I think there's an audience for that. I think those are probably the watches that personally to me are less exciting. But, you know, I had a conversation with Christian Knoop, who's their head of design, a couple weeks ago. And like, this is a watch that's important to this company. Like, it's meaningful for them. And he thought it deserved more attention. He thought they could kind of refine it and take it to the next level. And, you know, talking to him about the details, the way the bracelet's constructed, the way the movement is, you know, kind of sits in the case and allows them to do certain things with the dial, it's really well thought out. And it's, I think, you know, similar to the way where like the Pasha is not a watch for me, but I respect it for what it is. I think I feel the same way about Yacht Club, right? Like it's important for IWC to have a sports chronograph in this lineup and one with a high-end movement in it. Am I buying it? No, but like, I don't think when they were sitting in meetings trying to figure out, you know, who was going to buy this product, I don't think I'm the guy who came to mind anyway. So, you know, everybody wins here. Nobody's losing out.
Yeah. And I think like of all the Richemont brands, like IWC has the broadest appeal. Like, you know, this is the, you know, the Mercedes-Benz of watchmaking. Like, you know, Mercedes-Benz has the AMG GT, which like can compete with the 911. Is it as good? It might be. It depends on what you're looking at. But like, it's not a true, you know, Mercedes is known for being a sports car, but then they also make, you know, the G-Wagon, and then they also make the E-Class, which your parents drive. And then they also make the A-Class, which, you know, can be used as taxi cabs. Like IWC can do all that. And I think, you know, that is a really, as far as I'm concerned, it's really the only brand within the group and the only brand really showing at Watches and Wonders that like can do a little bit of everything. There it has the biggest potential. I mean, this is a brand that has massive, massive appeal, at least in our market, in the US market. And I think really, you know, is doing well and can do much better over the next, you know, five or 10 years if they have strong product, which, you know, they have right now.
Yeah. It looks like a really strong lineup this year to me.
Yeah, I agree. I think the funny thing is the biggest news maybe was kind of like to say it was leaked, I think is maybe not the right way to position it, but it rolled out to stores early and quietly, and they're only announcing it now, but it's been out there, which is that the Portuguese chronograph, which I think after that 7-day, like, you know, two subdial watch that Ben was referring to is probably the next most recognizable and influential Portuguese model, the two register chronograph. It now has an in-house movement, and it didn't get any more expensive. Like, it's still, you know, around $8,000 US in steel, and it has an in-house movement now. And like, that's big stuff. And it has a display back. You can see the movement. It's like a full-fledged modern IWC movement made in their new facility. And like, that's a big thing to, again, just kind of like quietly drop into boutiques and then be like, oh yeah, it's, you know, we updated it.
To me, one of the greatest things about that watch is they didn't change the design at all.
Right. I think you're right, because I remember, you know, they did something called the Portuguese Chronograph Classic, and then the Portuguese Chronograph maybe 5 years ago or so, and it was a little bit bulkier of a case for the in-house one. It was actually very confusing that they had like the in-house in like the yacht clubby Chronograph Classic, and then they had the Valjoux in the other one. When ultimately people just want the original, you know, and I think I've got it pulled up on my phone here. And yeah, you're right. I mean, this looks just like the watch that we all kind of like know and love from years ago, but now is in-house. And I think it's, you know, I think it's a banger. It's, you know, it's exactly what people want. It's 7,950 in steel.
That's great.
And that came out in January.
I never minded the 7750 in it at all. This is a fantastic thing to have.
Yeah. I think the other two watches, you know, before we move on from IWC, because I think we could probably fill a whole show talking about this collection, but the other two watches I really liked are, they took two watches, the basic automatic and the perpetual calendar, and they created versions that were simpler and smaller, but they didn't get rid of the others. So We've now got an automatic Portugueser that's 40 millimeters, which is the smallest Portugueser I've ever heard of. And we've got a perpetual that's 42 millimeters and has, like Ben said, this kind of classic three register layout with a moon phase, no year indicator, none of that stuff. It's a much more classic kind of take on the perpetual. And I think this is such a smart move for them. I think, like, you know, creating something slightly smaller, slightly more affordable, a little more pared down, is a great move. And it really fills out that collection. And now you've got, again, in a similar way, in a sort of similar way, I guess, to what AP is doing, right? Like, you now, there's basically a Portugueser in every size, every complication level, every price point. And so if you're into this design, if you're into the idea of this collection, you can find something. Like, there's no more holes. Basically, from 40 millimeters to like 46 or 47 millimeters, there's a watch for you. And also starting it around, I guess, like, you know, $7,000, $6,000, and going up to hundreds of thousands of dollars for the complicated pieces. You know, if we go on to, I think the last brand that really went super hard this year is Panerai. And I think, you know, it's an anniversary year. It's a big year for the Luminor. And they went hard. There's a lot of watches here. And I think, you know, for people who are maybe not diehard Panerai, you would look at these and be like, wait a minute, these all look the same. But you dig into the specs and you realize they're different sizes. They're made of different materials, in some cases, different movements. But yeah, there's a lot to like here from Panerai. I mean, Jack, was there anything that really caught your eye here?
I mean, you know, I have a helpless, hopeless love of anything that glows in the dark. So the Luminor Marina, 70 years of Luminor collection. I just loved it. I mean, I'd spend more time in a dark room than I already do if I had one of those watches.
Yeah, I mean, it's all neat stuff. I mean, I think, you know, Panerai, you know, kind of plays to their fan base better than almost any contemporary brand. Like, they know exactly what their guys want, and they do it year after year after year. You know, I think it's a little bit like Richard Mille in some way, where it's just like you kind of don't have to get it to like really appreciate what they're doing here. You know, it's one of those things where, like, this brand, like, these are going to sell out. You know, there's just no question that these are going to be gone before, you know. I mean, as soon as we publish these stories, I'm sure, like, these boutiques are getting emails and calls. You know, they really have stuck to their guns and haven't tried to deviate from the model too much, and it works.
I'm with Jack. I love these glow in the dark pieces. They're super over the top. They're the 70 years of Luminor collection. It's basically three watches that are technically very similar. One's titanium, one's Carbotech, and one's Fibrotech, which are two different sort of like synthetic case compounds. But they're just awesome. Like, they're these big, weird, glow-in-the-dark watches. And I think they inject a little bit of fun into what can sometimes feel like a very serious, kind of like old-school military watch. They kind of like wink at you, and I like that. I think it's a fun approach for Panerai to take, and it's not something I expected. I was really shocked when I kind of opened up an email and saw these.
Yeah, I also really like the fact that they aren't dilettantes when it comes to exploring new case materials. I mean, I feel like there's some, you know, new alloy or composite or compound with you know, high performance specs, you know, that comes out every time they launch a new collection. And the Fibrotech was something that I've certainly never heard of before. A composite made of extruded basalt fibers, which is much, you know, it's basalt is a volcanic mineral. And it's a relatively new composite. It has applications, has structural applications. You can weave fabrics out of it. It's just really, really cool stuff if you're, like, you know, I guess if you're a materials science geek. But it's
which
just really...
You are, right?
A little bit, yeah. You know, but to me, it's really neat that they're just taking this, you know, seriously. It's not like this year we're bringing out a new, you know, variety of titanium, or you know, we figured out a new way to squeeze carbon fibers together. It's really like new stuff in terms of applications watchmaking.
Cool. Yeah, the other Panerai that I wanted to highlight is it has kind of a cumbersome name. It's the Submersible Eco Pangea Tourbillon GMT 50 millimeter Mike Horn Edition. Like, okay, I guess that's a little difficult there. I guess if you want the shorthand, it's the PAM 1108. That's much easier. But this kind of follows, I wouldn't call it a trend, but it follows a line that Panerai started last year, which was these watches that come with experiences, which I think is an interesting, like, very 21st century, like, internet-y sort of way to sell something. Yeah. Which is that when you buy one of these experience watches, you get to partake in an experience. So whether it's training with a Navy SEAL or going on an expedition, whatever, if you buy the watch, you get to participate. So for this watch, it's super limited. It's 5 pieces, and you get to go on an Arctic expedition with Mike Horn, who is one of the leading explorers in the world. It's pretty awesome. The 50 millimeter skeletonized tourbillon is a lot. It's a pretty intense watch, but I guess if you're going to go to the Arctic, I guess it might make sense.
I also have to say, I think we had an opportunity to meet Mike Horn, and just once, and my God, that man has a firm handshake. If there's anyone else, I would follow.
I was say the same thing.
Really?
So actually, I don't know if I was with you, Jack, or not. This was early days. I actually went sailing with Mike Horn around just New York, you know, around the tip here. And he had me, I don't even know what it's called, when you kind of like go like this and crank up a sail. And at a certain point, like, he was on one side and I was on the other. And I was just kind of like trying to keep up with him. And he was basically doing it like one-handed. I mean, he is just like, he's such a man, you know, he's a hyperman. But yeah. He's an amazing guy. If you guys don't actually know who Mike Horn is, he's worth just like looking him up on Wikipedia. If he were going to wear a watch, which he does, it would be a Panerai that's 50 millimeters in size for sure.
Yeah. I like on like, you know, you just brought it up, right? Like, you got to experience this guy and he makes sense in the context of the brand. I think It's a cool way for these brands to utilize brand ambassadors in a way that doesn't feel like BS. Like, you know, this isn't somebody who you hire and you shoot an advertising campaign and they wear it on a red carpet. This is like, this guy gets to use the products. The people who buy the products get to meet him and experience it. Like, it's a cool thing to do. And they, you know, they work with other folks like Jimmy Chin, who are just these amazing human beings. And to put watches in that context, I think is both just fun. It's just flat out fun. And I think it's also a good thing for watches. Like, I think it's cool to make watches feel aspirational in that way. And in a way that's tangible and not just like on a page.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I completely agree. I mean, Mike Horn is like, when I met him, you know, you meet some people that like are not celebrities, but just are interesting people. And it's like, wow, like, you know, it'd be amazing to live your life like that guy lives his life. And he's one of those people. And I think, you know, more directly to the experience idea, you know, we did that as well this year with our Montblanc chronograph, which included a trip to Villeray with actually the Jack Forster. And I know, and Russell Ankara, and you know, the all of us, you know, usual suspects. And, you know, the idea was so well received. That we will definitely do it again. I mean, you know, this was kind of a beta for us, but people love it, you know, and it's just like you get to do stuff that is so different. And again, you know, the four or the three of us on the call, rather, like, we kind of get to live and breathe this stuff every day. And, you know, under normal circumstances, we're in Switzerland all the time and, you know, kind of, you know, traveling about the world doing crazy things. But like, as somebody, you know, who used to have a very boring job that involves sitting in a cubicle in Weehawken, New Jersey, like, I would die to go to Switzerland and, you know, see how my chronograph was made. And I think, you know, that there is real demand for stuff like that, because the average person that's the consumer of these products are not traveling. Like, they're working a 9-to-5. They're a doctor, a lawyer, a banker, an accountant, whatever. And I think it's just a really nice way to put your product into new perspective. So I think it's a great idea.
Sweet. All right. I think we have to move on, because otherwise this podcast is going to end up being like 4 hours long before we get through everybody. But the next brand I want to talk about moves us to a new kind of category. And that's brands doing something somewhere in the middle. And I think Vacheron kind of exemplifies this for me this year. Vacheron Constantin is releasing new substantive products, but they didn't overhaul a whole line. They didn't, you know, shake up the whole catalog, but I think they showed a really nice kind of measured approach, doing things that are very them, and kind of building collections incrementally, mostly at the higher end, I'll say, with a few 56 introductions to kind of, you know, appeal to the lower end, but the lower end of what they do, which is not low end at all. But to me, the standout piece here was the Overseas Perpetual as a skeleton.
It's killer.
That watch is so awesome. I think this is definitely top like two or three for me from the whole collection we've seen from all the brands. Of watches that, like, I really can't wait to get my hands on.
Yeah, and I completely agree. And I think, like, there's a story that our friend Paul Boutros, who used to write for us, wrote many, many years ago. And it was about the traditional skeleton perpetual
He sent me a text when he published this, you know, maybe 6-7 years ago. And he's like, dude, this is the best perpetual calendar I've ever seen. Like, just straight up, you know, the movement, the skeletonization that Vacheron does is next level. Look, Patek does it, AP does it, you know, all the big guys do it. This is really next level, you know, and I think Watch will do exceptionally well. You know, AP has a skeleton in steel, gold, and now ceramic as well. I think this is just as good looking. You get the three straps. You know, it's going to kill for Vacheron. I have no doubt about that.
Yeah. Jack, you wrote up some of the Cabinotier pieces, right? The unique complications as well, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting stuff to write about because, you know, I mean, Vacheron has a couple of really interesting sort of core competencies or core characteristics that have carried through a lot of its history. And they're very, very strong on the métier d'art stuff, on enameling and engraving, open working. You know, it's, you know, as Ben was saying, it's really, you know, top of its class. But they're also very well known as a complications maker. And, you know, it's easy to forget, but it wasn't that long ago that they actually launched the most complicated watch ever that anyone has ever made. The 57260 pocket watch with 57 complications. So what they sort of have been doing is taking that that pocket watch and using it as a sort of a jumping off point for exploring other things that are, you know, wristwatch size, a little bit more wearable, a little bit less complicated, but still still quite complicated pieces. And they're doing them as unique pieces. So we had, let's see, what did we have? We had the Le Cabinotier Astronomical Striking Grand Complication Ode to Music. And we had a timing focused one called simply the Tempo. And both of these watches are double-sided watches. One of them has 19 and I think the other 22 complications. And you know, it's really, really classic high-end watchmaking. But the interesting thing to me is they're actually both really wearable. You know, the Ode to Music, for example, is a chiming watch. It's an astronomical watch, but it's built on their ultra-thin 1731 minute repeater movement. So despite the fact that it's an extremely complex watch and it delivers a lot of information, it's actually very elegant. I've had a chance to see some of the Le Cabinotier unique pieces in person, and they're just really, really beautifully wearable watches. It's kind of like, you know, you need a certain amount of real estate for the dial not to end up looking, you know, just cluttered, but they've figured out a way to sort of organize the movements in such a way that the watch remains, you know, sort of wearable dimensions. And we have to remember the way the movement is organized determines how information is organized on the dial. So you have to be thinking about, this is something that Breguet was famously really good at. You have to be thinking about the final outcome at the same time that you're thinking about movement architecture. And there's very, very few companies in the world that can do that. And I think Vacheron does it beautifully.
Yeah, I think I've said this before on the show, but Vacheron was the first watch manufacturer I ever got to visit back in, I guess it was 2012. Yeah, 2012. And it was funny because I got to see, you know, the Métier workshop. I got to see the Cabinotier workshop. I got to chat with a watchmaker who was working on their 14-day tourbillon, right? And I was like, oh, this is what a watch factory is like. Like, this is what a manufacturer is. And then I went to visit a few other watch manufacturers, and I was like, oh, this isn't, okay, that's not normal at all. Like, I had no idea when I went that the amazing things that Vacheron is able to collect under that one roof just outside of Geneva is insane. And like, I still don't know that I've ever been to a manufacturer where that many sort of like individual skills and crafts that are either watchmaking or watchmaking adjacent are all done in one place and kind of in concert like that. And it's cool to see them flex their muscles like this. Like, they can do it in a way that like almost nobody else, maybe nobody else can.
It's a really overwhelming place to visit. You know, I mean, I will never forget the first time that I went there. It was like you walk into a room where movement finishing is being done and it's best of class movement finishing. And you walk into a room where gem setting is being done and it's best of class gem setting. Enameling, it's best of class enameling. Engraving, it's best of class engraving. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Yeah. All right. We're going to have to move on to a semi-lightning round here because I want to make sure we get in the other highlight releases. So we're not going to talk about everything. We're not going to talk about every brand. People should check out. We'll link it up in the show notes here. We have a landing page on the site, a collection page where you can see all of our Watches and Wonders coverage. But, you know, to go through some highlights, there were a bunch of brands who had smaller collections, right? They released a couple of updates. Sometimes it was one or two watches. Sometimes it was maybe three or four watches. But I think these are brands we may see more from them later this year. But they're still plenty of interesting stuff now. So to kick off that section, let's talk about Longa. Longa had a new Zeitwerk minute repeater with a blue dial, which is beautiful. But I think maybe the more interesting thing is the Odysseus in white gold, not on a bracelet. You know, Jack, you reviewed the Odysseus for us just a couple weeks ago, actually. And kind of the whole idea behind that watch was that it was Longa's move into the integrated bracelet or semi-integrated bracelet steel semi-sport watch, like luxury sport watch category. And it came out in the fall, like I think November it was released. And now just a couple months later...
October 24th, right?
There we go. Perfect.
Right. Isn't that the day that they always do stuff?
Oh yeah, I think you're right. Yes.
I think so.
Yeah, I think you're right. But yeah, now we're seeing it in white gold, not on a bracelet. What do you think is the story there, Jack?
I don't know. I thought it was a fascinating thing to do, actually. I mean, you know, we all had it in our heads, like this is Longa's first steel watch. It's the first, not their first steel watch, but their first sort of series produced full production series watch, their first sports luxury watch. And, you know, you sort of think to yourself, okay, this is going to be where the steel is. And the second, the very, you know, right on the heels of the first release, they get this guy out in white gold, which really, I think I thought it was a fascinating thing to do. For one thing, it kind of makes it all about the design and not about the material. And, and I thought it was also pretty cool that if you want to have an Odysseus on a silicone strap, right now it comes with white gold.
Yeah, that's true. Ben, what are your thoughts on this thing?
Yeah, I'm a fan. I mean, I think the dial, the texturing of the dial is quite a bit different than the steel watch. Yeah. I think it works maybe a little bit better, not on the bracelet here. You know, I still think that there's some, you know, some quick changes that could really kind of set this thing off. But I happen to love the dial color, which is not a surprise. And I think it looks great. And I love the idea of it coming out with two different straps.
Yeah, same. I think, you know, I was not the biggest fan of the Odysseus when it came out. I'm still kind of up in the air about it, but I think seeing them move it in this direction tells me that they're thinking about a bunch of different options. And I think it's probably not too long before I'm a convert.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but I would imagine that we're, you know, this is going to be a whole family. So I would hope to see some more cool stuff coming soon.
Yeah. All right, let's go to another brand. I know we all loved this watch when it debuted last year, but there's five new models this year, and I think they're even cooler than the ones from last year, and that's the Hermès Arceau L'Heure de la Lune. That watch is insane. It's so Hermès. I can't imagine anybody else doing it. It's got these two, you know, your hour dial and your hours and minutes dial, and then your date dial. Kind of spin over the top of these two moons. It's a dual moon phase indicator. The one last year came with, there was an option with a meteorite dial. And this year, there's five new dials, three of which are different kinds of meteorite. One of which is lunar meteorite, which is awesome. You can literally wear a piece of the moon on your wrist. And the other one is a Martian meteorite dial. You can literally wear a piece of Mars on your wrist. They're only making two pieces. It's price on request. I requested and was politely told no.
So, I know you're not a serious buyer.
Yeah, I was like, can I make the request? And they were like, no, you can't. So I was told no, but you know, it just makes me want it more. I asked. Yeah, I tried. But yeah, I kind of like the moment I saw these watches, I was like, holy shit, this is cool.
A lot of other brands could try to do something like this, but it wouldn't really make sense with anybody but Hermès.
Yeah, Jack, I would imagine you have some feelings about these watches.
Oh, I mean, I love them when they first came out. And, you know, I'm with you on the Martian meteorite. You know, the idea of having something that was hurled into interplanetary space, found its way to Earth, and is now on arguably, you know, the most beautiful moon phase watch anybody has out there is just, I mean, come on. I would have asked too.
Well, you know, maybe if Jack sold that house that he's in over there, he could probably afford one.
Yeah.
You know, one or two.
All right, up next, let's go to something that it actually doesn't drop till tomorrow morning. So it's as of recording, it's not out there, but I want to make sure we talk about it, is the Piaget Altiplano Ultimate Concept, which debuted a couple years ago as a concept watch. I mean, as the name would indicate, as a concept watch. It's the thinnest mechanical watch in the world. I believe it's 2 millimeters.
Exactly two millimeters,
top to bottom. I wrote a little hands-on story with it. Jack has written a hands-on story with it. It's insane. It's an absolutely insane little mechanical thing. It's now commercially available. Like, they figured out how to make it a thing that you can actually buy and that's serviceable and all of that. And you're going to be able to personalize it too. So you'll be able to order, you know, I want the time-telling dial this color and the base plate this color, and I want this strap on it. So you'll be able to kind of make it your own thing. I think that's a pretty cool thing from Piaget.
I gotta say, I didn't give them a snowball's chance in hell, honestly, of being able to produce this thing on any kind of commercial level. I mean, yeah, same. It's kind of amazing.
This requires like a wrench to wind it up.
It has a crown, but the crown is actually a little inset rectangle in order not to increase the diameter of the watch or interrupt the contour of the case. And the case metal, it's some like high-tech cobalt alloy. They needed something, you know, because it's only 2 millimeters thick, they needed something a lot more rigid than, conventional case material. So, you know, like, I mean, there's a million really cool technical solutions in this thing. Also, I asked them how much, and also they wouldn't tell me.
Okay. We're striking out here, Jack.
I mean, it's very
sick right now. Huh?
It's very clear, on what level as individuals we're regarded as serious customers for some of this stuff.
It's true.
It's like me asking for a test drive in a Bugatti Chiron.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. Sorry. All right, let's keep going. Let's go opposite end of the spectrum. Let's go to Mont Blanc. Mont Blanc is, they've already released some things this year. We got some heritage pieces from them. And we got a couple 1858 pieces, but they released two more 1858 pieces. One is a new mono pusher that includes a bronze limited edition, and one is a 24-hour dial watch that I find weirdly charming. Like, I didn't expect to like it at all, but I'm kind of into it.
Yeah, and I think it's really nice stuff. I mean, some of the stuff Jack and I saw under embargo when we were at Villeray earlier this year, and I think it's really great stuff. The bracelet in particular, or the bracelet work that Mont Blanc is doing, I mean, it's true to form, proper vintage, you know, Davide Cerato kind of level detail. You know, it would fit perfectly on like a 1960s Heuer Octavia as well. You know, it's really gay Freire style. The details, as always, are wonderful on this stuff. And, you know, we're obviously a retailer of some of the Mont Blanc stuff. And people love it. I mean, it goes all day, every day. You know, it's really, really nice stuff. And then, of course, you have the Villeray product, which I know Jack is a fan of, and so am I. I mean, this is as good as anything out there. So it's you know, I think there's still a bit of a disconnect in terms of having, you know, people at scale really appreciate the difference between the 1858 stuff and the Villeray stuff. And I understand that. You know, I think that there's no question that we're getting a little bit more concise with our messaging from Mont Blanc. But either way, both products are wonderful. They just serve totally different purposes.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, Stephen, I agree with you. I found I really thought I was just going to find the 24-hour watch gimmicky, but there's something kind of irresistible about it.
Yeah. I also said this, and I wrote it up for the site, and I said this in the story, but like, I'm just happy they're doing something different. Like, so many brands, especially in that price point, like when you look at watches in the $3,000 to $6,000 price bracket, it's same. Like, everybody wants a time and date. Everybody wants a chronograph. Everybody wants, you know, preferably a three register chronograph with a date window. Like, it's the same stuff over and over. Maybe some sort of travel or GMT complication. But I like that Mont Blanc, like, they did a GMT, but they did it as the Geospheres. Like, they wanted to do something, you know, kind of adventure-y. They did a 24-hour dial. Like, they're not just making the same watches that everybody else is making. They're doing something that sets them apart. And I think, you know, it's a very Davide strategy, and I think it's a winning strategy.
I agree. I mean, I think you just nailed it. Like, they're not making me two watches at all, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah. All right. You know, I think the last thing I want to talk about here is one of the more interesting watches and more, I think, probably divisive watches that we're going to see, which is a watch from Laurent Ferrier. I want to make sure we get an independent in here. This is the Tourbillon Grand Sport on the bracelet.
Yeah.
This is like a low-key mega watch here.
I love it, yeah.
You love it?
I do. Look, I mean, I think
tell me
it's
why.
Complete. Well, it's absurd in many ways. Everything we talk about is absurd. This is extremely absurd. This is, what is this, $180,000?
Yeah, I think around that.
Yeah, so let's say it's 100,
between 160 and 190,000 US dollars. It's a stainless steel sports watch with a hidden tourbillon on the back. They announced this watch last year in, I think, titanium, or maybe in steel, on a rubber strap. And they did 12 watches to kind of celebrate the anniversary of Mr. Ferrier's win or second place finish, I forget, at Le Mans. And, you know, why not? You know, like, let's do this. But I think it really works on the bracelet. The movement is fantastic. I mean, an LF kind of reverse tourbillon is one of my – I remember the first time I saw the Laurent Ferrier tourbillon. It was at – I don't even remember the name of the watch show in downtown Geneva that used to kind of run alongside SIHH. Shaq, do you remember that?
Oh, gosh. Did it have a separate name?
It did, yeah. I forget. Maybe GTE or Geneva Time
Estimation. Oh, yeah. That was it.
I think the GTE. So, I mean, LF was there among other brands, many of which are now totally defunct. And I saw this thing, and it was probably William or somebody who told me about them first. And it turned around, and I was like, oh, my God. Like, you know, this is one of the most beautiful movements I've ever seen. It looks like a Patek tourbillon from, like, the 50s, you know? That's effectively what you have on the other side of this watch that in many ways looks a little bit like a Nautilus. You know, if you know Laurent's background with Patek, that makes a lot of sense. I think the case is wonderful. The movement is wonderful. There's some things I would personally change about the dial, the hands, etc. But I love the idea of this watch very, very much. And, you guys know me. Like, I love a good sleeper watch. Like, I love a good, like, holy shit, like, this is like a Ferrari that looks like a Toyota type of thing. Yeah. And that's basically what this is. Is the price justified? Who knows? Is the quality excellent? I would guarantee it. It's Laurent Ferrier. It's a really cool thing. And, like, if I ever come across somebody wearing this watch, I'm going to be like, yeah, man, like you're the man. You're doing it right now.
Nice. Yeah, I totally agree. I you know, I'm with you. The dial and the hands and the markers, like, not totally my taste, but the idea of this watch and the execution and the movement are absurd. They're just so next level. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, there will be buyers for this watch for sure.
For sure.
I just double checked the price. It's 172,000 Swiss. But hey, you know, any double balanced spring tourbillon finished to that level is it's okay by me.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's the same. That's actually less than a 5740 on the secondary market, you know, which is the Nautilus perpetual calendar in white gold. Like, that watch is 130, I think, retail. This is a tourbillon. It's an independent. You put those things side by side. I think you know, if you're not talking about brand recognition, which of course Patek would win, and you're just talking about quality and watchmaking, like the LF is going to hold its weight, no question about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for us for now. I know Jack and I both have stories to finish for tomorrow, so we'll get out of here. But I would encourage everybody listening here, go down to the show notes, go read up about these watches. Everybody on the editorial team at Hodinkee put a ton of work into producing these stories and making them as thoughtful as possible. So, like I said, you're going to get the specs. That's all there. Fine. But you're also going to get our kind of take, some info about the context, where this thing sits in the market, what it's building on, what it's like, what it's not like, all of that. So, you know, in this age right now where, like, we're not getting to see watches in the metal, at least short term, I think our team's put together probably the closest thing you're going to get to what these watches are actually like and what the experience of them is like. So go check all of that out. Make sure you visit Hodinkee. We're going to have more coverage for you all of the week that this is running and beyond. I think we're starting to see new products come out, and I think other brands that aren't showing stuff now are going to start. So I think it's the beginning of the year's cycle.
I agree. Yeah, it's the first, like, full on excitement that we've had in the watch industry in 2020. So it's good to be back.
Yeah. All right. Good to see you guys, and enjoy the weekend, and see you soon.
All right. See you guys.
Take care.
Thanks, guys. This week's episode was recorded remotely by our group of editors and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.